south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
All right, a couple of things on our agenda today. A few things we didn't get to because we ran out of time last week. If you remember, at the end of the last show, we had Dan, not his real name's email, probably one of the most un-PC emails we've ever read. He asked if in Latin America the same thing's happening like from where he's from up in Canada. Actually, he's from India, but he's a Canadian. He asked if affirmative action and equity hiring in Latin America has taken off like it's taken off in the first world, specifically Canada, where he said in his last email that it's ruining the Canadian mining industry, which he is a part of. So he knows what he's talking about. My answer to his question as to whether affirmative action or equity hiring is starting to take over here in Latin America too, I'd have to say absolutely not. I'm not seeing any signs of equity hiring or affirmative action hiring here in Latin America, but I am seeing one of the biggest, most obvious reasons why Latin American companies are not competitive with their first world counterparts, and they've never been. It's because of the extreme amount of nepotism you see down here in Latin American companies. Man, I'll tell you, they've got some of the biggest companies in the world down here. You know, traditional companies like cement, steel, plastic, beer, soft drinks like Pepsi and Coca-Cola. Almost all of them family-owned, with family members throughout the corporate structure. They've even got all kinds of franchise fast food outlets that are similar to Kentucky Fried Chicken and McDonald's, Wendy's, etc. Also, mostly family-owned, and their corporate structures are just saturated with nepotism, too. Why do you think almost none of them could ever survive if they were transplanted up to the first world and had to face real first-world competition? Though they've tried, they fail practically every time. You know, I've been seeing what's happening with these Latin American companies for a lot of years. I got lots of friends who work at them. And the nepotism problem, man, it's a cancer. But of course, the family members themselves don't look at it that way. To them, it's absolutely normal to put all the family members on the payroll. From the smart ones to the mediocre ones, to the slugs and the mental defectives in the family, too. By the way, that's one of the reasons why you have such a great gringo advantage in business. If you start a business down here, you've got a big leg up because your competition, the Latin competition that is, could never survive up in the first world. Though there's one famous example I've mentioned a couple of times in the show a long time ago. A business, a food franchise, that's actually thriving big time up in the States right now. Though it failed the first time, but struck gold second time around. Its name? Pollo Campero. And you know, I don't think I could get in trouble or get sued by calling it the greasiest, most unhealthy chicken-licking franchise I've ever been in. But it is the most famous, most beloved chicken-licking franchise in all Latin America. By the way, its origin was Guatemala City. So then you might ask, why am I dissing the product? Well, let's put it this way. If you want to induce a gallbladder attack, just head to Pollo Campero and buy a bucket. I certainly can't eat this stuff because I found that about an hour later, it's like somebody poured a load of cement down my throat. Oh, and if you think I'm exaggerating, just walk in. Don't buy anything. Just stand around for about 20 minutes, then walk out. You won't be able to get the rancid oil smell out of your clothes, your hair, your nostrils, everything. But Latin Americans with their cast iron stomachs just love the stuff. In fact, for middle class and lower middle class Latin Americans of a certain age, going to Pollo Campero is date night. And man, is it popular. It's number one with the locals as far as a chicken licking place. Beats the pants off the colonel who's down here too. Not in flavor by any means, but by cash register kajings. Last time I looked, or last time I talked to any executive from that company, I happen to know someone there who's an executive. He said they've got over 1,000 franchise Pollo Campero outlets in Central and South America. In fact, some years back, that guy, that Pollo Campero executive, was the lead player in one of my bands. Went to university in Guatemala, got a business degree, got a job as an executive at Pollo Campero because of his dad, an MD, a doctor whose college buddy is a bigwig at Pollo Campero. Nepotism in action. But that's not all. The drummer in one of my past bands has the famous Latin American last name of Castillo. Means castle in English. His family owns the famous Latin American beer, Gallo Beer, and they own the Pepsi and Coca-Cola franchises too. Funny thing, at lots of our gigs, his family and friends would show up, and all of them had jobs at either the beer company or Pepsi or Coca-Cola. Now, how'd that happen? Of course, they were all highly qualified merit hires. Yeah, right. I noticed that up and down the hierarchy of those three companies, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, the Gallo Beer, even Brava Beer, the biggest competitor to Gallo Beer, the upper and middle management was pretty much entirely staffed by family members. Lots of them I met, and lots of them were fat-ass, do-nothing slugs just taking up a parking space who I wouldn't hire to flip hamburgers at a burger joint. So as for Dan's question, Dan's not his real name, his question, have Latin American companies been infiltrated by affirmative action programs and equity hires? I can say unequivocally, nope. But because there's so much crony and nepotism hiring here in Latin America, the result is pretty much the same, or worse, as it relates to productivity, that is. Of course, I'm talking about private industry. In government, it's a bit different. The thing is, throughout Latin America, where they have indigenous populations, they've been treated as second-class citizens. And in just the last couple of years, government's been trying to make up for that by hiring a greater percentage of indigenous people, but mostly for low-end jobs. So they are making an effort. Meanwhile, at the top of the corrupt food chain in Latin American governments are the taller, whiter Latinos with more pure Spanish blood. It's the Latin American version of the government club George Carlin used to talk about. The exclusive membership club that you ain't in. Oh, and I forgot to mention the two particular Latin American industries that do well competing in the first world. The only two. The beer and liquor industries. Examples being Corona beer, Dos Equis, tequila and rum coming out of Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. And the reason why those can break into an American or Canadian or European market is that they're produced so cheaply it's impossible not to make money. It's all about the labor costs. And let's face it, booze is booze, beer is beer. There's no secret or magic formula. Oh, wait a minute, Johnny, you say? You're a connoisseur. You're one of those people who thinks you can tell the difference between brands. I don't care how discriminating a beer drinker you think you are. I'll bet you a Bitcoin. If I put 5 beers in front of you, all in identical glasses, you couldn't match all 5 to their names. You probably couldn't match 3 out of 5. Same thing goes for rum and tequila. Though you probably could tell an expensive tequila from a cheap one because the expensive ones are really smooth. But still, you'd have to be a world-class tequila drinker to sort that out. And still, you might not be able to pick out the names of 3 out of 5 set in front of you. That's why I always have to laugh when I hear some gringo tell me I only drink Budweiser, Miller, Coors, Michelob, whatever. Brand loyalty, that's good, but the fact is, thousands upon thousands of blind taste tests have been done, and it's been proven it's all in your mind. That goes for cheap and expensive wines, too. So, even though Latin beer and tequila companies that have made it to the first world and have achieved brand loyalty, if you check those company files, you'll notice those places are saturated with nepotism. The fact that they can make it so damn cheap in their home countries because of labor costs, and it ships well. I mean, look, beer, rum, and tequila do not have a shelf life, right? If anything, they get better with age. But anything else, any other product coming out of Central South America or the Caribbean, just cannot stand up to first world competition. So the question remains, which is worse for a big company? Or for the end product the company produces? Affirmative action and meritless equity hires? Or simply rampant nepotism hires? Well, who knows, but maybe some business school or sociology or marketing departments doing a study on that would be interesting to find out. Sounds like a great topic for a master's thesis. Though I bet the results would be totally un-PC. Mainstream media might never touch it. They wouldn't want to open that can of worms. Yep. We seem to be living in a world of journalistic cowards. Kind of depressing, wouldn't you say? Just saying, but maybe it's me. Maybe I'm the jerk. So, if you think I'm a jerk, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. By the way, I just got a couple of emails from people calling me a jerk. for calling out on a show last week the brutal assault on our ears coming from rappers and reggaetoneros. Yep, right after I went on that rant, I got a couple of emails in defense of rap and reggaeton. Hey, I can see if you're a person that really loves to dance. Dancing is part of your lifestyle, which it is in Latin America. Then rap and reggaeton are your thing. Okay, I get that. However, I've yet to meet a single gringo male who doesn't think it sucks. By the way, I'm not saying that all rappers and reggaetoneros are idiots. In fact, in any field, music, art, science, whatever, the people that reach the top, the pinnacle, are much smarter than average. To get to the top, it's about brains and luck. Take, for example, the dead rapper Tupac. You know, as far as I could see, he had to be a pretty smart guy not to name himself Six-Pack. Because rappers, you know, as they age out, they either end up getting shot or looking like Barry White. So it would be much easier for any rapper lucky enough to age out to maintain a 2-pack than a 6-pack. And take the rapper 50 Cent. He must have been a very smart guy too. Smart enough anyway not to have named himself 50 Million. Because, you know, as rappers age out, the ones that live end up like brain-damaged boxers. After all the excesses, the gold-plated Cadillacs, jacuzzis, and toilets, they end up broke. So my hat's off to 50 Cent. He must have been clairvoyant. But I digress as usual. We were talking about Pollo Campero, weren't we? It's a case for the business school textbooks, since they completely failed first time around. It came back 10 years later and hit it big. First time around, they closed up shop because they couldn't compete with the other chicken lickens like Kentucky Fried. So the Pollo Campero staff in the States came home to Guatemala with their tail between their legs. Then, some 10 years later, about 2010, some astute Pollo Campero marketer took notice that the little tiny hole in the wall Pollo Campero at the airport in Guatemala City at Aurora Airport. That little hole in the wall Pollo Campero was making more money than any of their big franchise units around Guatemala and Central America. Well, someone at Pollo Campero put two and two together and figured out most all Guatemalans flying from Guatemala City to the States were carrying Pollo Campero care packages back home to the States to their friends and relatives as a gift. Turns out Guatemalans living in the United States had a craving for Pollo Campero. To them, it was a touch of home. Now, where do you think all the Guatemalans in the U.S. are living? In little Latino barrios in L.A., Chicago, New York, New Jersey, Miami, etc. So a light bulb went off in a Pollo Campero marketing guy's head. He thought, let's open up some Pollo Camperos in Latino barrios in big cities in the States where all the immigrant Guatemalans live. Let's not do what we did 10 years ago. Put our chicken joints in white bread strip malls. Let's put them smack dab in the middle of Latino neighborhoods where Guatemalans live. And man, that turned out to be a big success. And now there are lots and lots of Pollo Camperos in the United States, one of the first and only examples of a pure Latin American franchise that's ever made a success of it in the U.S., or anywhere outside of Latin America, for that matter. All right, moving on. Here's an interesting email from Dave. He says, Johnny, I wanted to share an article with you that I read today about what's called palo terapia. In English, that means stick therapy. I know you like neighborhood vigilante stories. Well, this one's coming out of Colombia from the newspaper El Informador. He says, Johnny, for me, it was a refreshing read. In the U.S., I once used palo therapy, stick therapy, on a home invader and almost faced felony charges while the home invader went free. Another messed up example of life in the police state called the United States. But anyway, Johnny, I hope you enjoyed the read and thanks for the podcast. I've listened to every one of them over the years. I've lived in Central America and will probably be returning in the near future. Signed, Dave. Yep, another Dave. All right, thanks for that, Dave. You know, I think a lot of people sign their emails Dave now because they know it gets me going because they know I've got so many listeners, virtual and otherwise, named Dave. So anyway, let me translate the article Dave sent me from the newspaper El Informador in Colombia. It says, in the early hours yesterday at exactly 12:30 a.m., an act of community courage and justice was recorded in the Bastidas neighborhood, Colombia, when the community came together to capture a criminal who attempted to commit a robbery on 10th Street and Avenue 34B. It says, the unidentified criminal approached a passerby with the intention of robbing him, but did not expect a courageous and unified response from the residents of Barrio Bastida. It says several neighbors, alerted by the victim's cries for help, quickly went to the scene and managed to subdue the wrongdoer. The neighbors, it says, without waiting for the intervention of the authorities, took justice into their own hands and applied what has been called palo therapy, stick therapy. In other words, they beat the hell out of them with sticks. It says images captured by witnesses show how the individual was subdued and held on site and beaten until the arrival of the Metropolitan Police. Some minutes after the incident, the Santa Marta Metropolitan Police arrived at the site to calm the situation and apprehend the criminal. Although the community had taken extreme measures, the authorities reaffirmed that justice should be imparted through the proper corresponding legal channels. None of the neighbors who beat the hell out of the guy were charged. All right, me Johnny here. Isn't that refreshing? The neighbors beat the hell out of a criminal in the act of thievery, and the cops did not arrest the neighbors. They actually arrested the thief. You know what else I like about living in Latin America? When you read a story like this, or you see a story in the news or in the media, they don't say things like suspected or alleged thief or criminal. When a guy's caught in the act or red-handed, they call a spade a spade. They tell it like it is. They say the criminal was apprehended or the thief was taken down. They don't say the suspected criminal or the alleged criminal. They call it like it is. They're not at all like the whining, sniveling first world journalists that cover stories up by you. Down here, when a guy's caught robbing, mugging, or thieving, he's called a damn robber, criminal, or a thief. No whining, woke sentiments allowed. Thank you very much. Yet another small reason I like living here in Latin America much better than living up by you. Fact is, I don't know how you can stand it. How's that Plan B coming anyway? Just wondering. All right, let's take another email. This one's from Mr. ALG Esquire. He says, "Hi there, Johnny. How's it going? I'm still working my way through your show. I'm on episode 123022 today. That's December 30th, 2022. Well, I don't think I could remember what I was talking about on that show for $1 million. Anyway, he says, "I was listening while hiking through exquisite trails near Leadville, Colorado, about 11,000 feet above sea level." He says, "It's one of the coolest temperature-wise places in the entire lower 48. Wow, Mr. AG, what about altitude sickness at 11,000 feet? I know some people claim they get it in places like Lake Atitlan or Antigua Guatemala in the Guatemalan Altiplano, which is only 5,000 to 6,000 feet above sea level. Though it's never affected me. At 11,000 feet, double that, you must be short of breath. And wouldn't you know it, no coca leaves to chew on to give you a legal leg up. Yet another reason you gotta love Latin America, huh?" Anyway, then he goes on to say, "At 11,000 feet above sea level, Leadville, Colorado is the highest incorporated town in America." Anyhow, he says, "I was listening to your show from December 30th, 2022 today, and there was some idiot asking you if you were retired. And after listening to your show, he says for 3 years he hasn't figured that out yet. As if he can't at least conclude that you're not retired to the extent you still spend a lot of time working on hosting seminars, consulting with folks, etc. What does he think that is if not retired? That said, Johnny," he says, "you never did actually answer the question about being retired. You said something about not liking the term and then jumped right into your father's story and his death, which I'm sorry about, and it scares the hell out of me at 52. So then, Johnny, how do you answer that question about your retirement when asked? Are you financially independent? I.e., could you quit earning any income now and be comfortable without ever having to work again? Speaking of that," he says, "I've started to sometimes tell folks that I'm on a long sabbatical instead of early retired, because in the event I decide or need to want to come back to work, I don't want too many of my former colleagues thinking I'll never go back to lawyering again. You know, just in case. So anyway, my answer is context dependent. And depending on who I'm talking to, I might use different terms, or as just explained, especially when I'm traveling and chatting with complete strangers. As for me," he says, "thankfully the stock market has been kicking ass lately, and so I have no intention of returning to law or otherwise working for money anytime soon. Signed, Mr. ALG Esquire. P.S. Go Trump, DeSantis, anyone but Biden." Well, thanks for that, Mr. A. And about that retirement question, you know, I digress a lot, so I guess I strayed off the track in December 22 as well. I guess you could actually say I retired about 31 years ago. And at that time, I had a little nest egg that I took with me out of the country. I thought, you know, eventually I'll have to work. If I had no job, my nest egg would probably last me 10 years. That's what I figured. I didn't really know. It was a crude estimate. Of course, not having any kids keeps a nest egg going a lot longer than it would otherwise. That meant no saving up for private school or kids' college or any of that. And, you know, I actually thought, look, no one ever helped me through college. I had a complete full boat scholarship through engineering school. That's 4 years, right? But after that, when I went on to graduate school and all that crap, my counselors and advisors and student aid people said they don't give white boys scholarships to go to graduate school. Undergrad, yeah. Graduate, no. Unless, of course, you're an Einstein, which I ain't. Yep, I had a student advisor, a counselor, and a student aid person tell me exactly that. They didn't say it in a nasty or condescending way. They just said if you were a person of color, you'd certainly get a grad school scholarship. So anyway, I went to grad school, got a couple of advanced degrees, and walked out with around $15,000 in student loan debt. Well, I paid it off on the payment plan, but that's the only debt I had when I left the country 31 years ago. Figuring with the nest egg I had, I'd last 10 years. Well, 10 years went by, and guess what? Playing in bands, being on the radio in Latin America, and having a few little successful businesses on the side, I still had the same nest egg, and even more, 10 years later. Then, 10 years after that, that'd be 20 years into the game. No steady job to speak of, just, again, playing the band, doing Latin American radio gigs, etc. Surprise, surprise, I had a bigger nest egg than when I started 20 years earlier. And that was about the time I got this podcast gig and Bitcoin came into existence. So, nope, I don't really need to work. But you got to do something. You got to stay active or you end up like a lot of overweight American couch potatoes, taking 5 prescription medicines at 50 and looking forward to those hip and knee replacements at 60. I'm definitely not on track to be one of those. So, am I retired? Nope, but I guess it depends on your definition of retirement. For some, you know, retirement is just being on the short list for the old folks home. Oh, and Mr. AG, you mentioned in your email I was talking about my dad dying. You know, he died at 54. He died on the operating table, being one of the first guys to get one of those balloon angioplasties, which they don't do anymore. Now they do stents, right? And those things have their weaknesses and pros and cons, too. Anyway, my dad got a balloon angioplasty at 54 in about 1980. When they inserted the balloon in him through his femoral artery and went into the coronary arteries in his heart, apparently the fiber optics they used in the old days weren't so flexible, kind of stiff. Unfortunately, they ruptured his artery and he died right there. Scary, huh? In the morning, he's talking just fine, thinking he's only going in as an outpatient to get this pretty new procedure that's so much quicker and safer than open-heart surgery, you know, a bypass. Yeah, well, everything has a risk, and he was that unlucky 1%. By the way, that morning I remember talking to my dad. He was a joker. I remember my mom said, "It's time to trade it in the car, but I don't trust used car salesmen." And my dad, sitting in his hospital bed, he said, "I trust a used car salesman more than I trust a guy with a purse." Now, he wasn't disparaging gay guys. He was referring to my sister's latest boyfriend, a hipster with a purse. All right, now, a sobering email from Kelsey, an expat insider repeat offender. He says, "Hey, Johnny, hope you're doing well. A buddy of mine in the States shared this copy of the hospital bill his parents received for his birth. He was born on April 5th, 1950. It's a simple one-page invoice. No insurance required. His dad paid cash. Easy peasy. No paperwork. No HIPA, no liability waivers, etc., etc. It must have been a slightly complicated birth because his mother spent 6 days in the maternity ward of that hospital. So Mr. K sent me a copy of this bill. I'm looking at it right now. It consists of an invoice with 8 lines on it. Let me go through this real quick. You'll find it amusing. Might want to cry, too. On line 1, it says, 6 days overnight in hospital, $10 a day. That's $60. Care of newborn, $2.50 a day for 6 days. That's $15. Anesthetic fee, $10. Medicine, $11.60. Laboratory work, $2. Grand total, no tax, $116.60. before childbirth and 6 days in the hospital. Okay, so that was in 1950. Now let's look at an inflation chart and see what that's worth in today's dollars. $116.60, 6 days in the hospital. All right, just plug that into an inflation calculator. It says that since 1950 to 2023, the cumulative rate of inflation since then is 1,168.4%. What a tragedy, huh? Anyway, in other words, Uncle Sam, your U.S. government has devalued, basically destroyed, the value of the dollar, thus decreasing its purchasing power by more than 10 times since 1950. Now, you didn't do that. Business didn't do that. Industry didn't do it. The U.S. government did. Through massive spending, massive printing of dollars, and bureaucratic expansion. But you knew that already, right? Even knowing all that, it's much worse than you think. Because if the person who was born in 1950, if his medical bills had just kept up with inflation, his bill, instead of being $116.60, would have been $1,478. Again, that's if his medical bills would have kept up with inflation, which itself is an astounding increase in the dollar cost, over $116.60. Problem is, if a kid's born today in 2023 and his mother had to spend 6 days in a maternity ward, if you look it up, you'll find the average invoice for that occurrence will not be $1,478, thus keeping up with inflation. Turns out, an average childbirth in the U.S. in 2023 is $5,591. That's a birth without complications. And every extra day in the hospital after the first 24 hours is around $1,000 extra. So, in the birth we were talking about in 1950, the mother stayed 6 days. That would be 5 extra days, or $5,000. In today's inflated dollars, that means an equivalent 6-day maternity stay would run slightly over $10,000 total. But wait a minute. According to the inflation calculator, it should only run $1,478. Can anybody explain to me how it could be more than 6 times as much as the inflation calculator says it should be? Of course, it's due to the hospital, big pharma, insurance company, industrial complex. Well, there is no way to win. There's no way to beat them except to pack your bags and get the hell out of Dodge. So, how's your plan be coming?
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos!